Gandalf's long shadow had finally swallowed Tom up. I went to him where he sat, bent and miserable, and stroked his hair as he buried his face against my belly. You mustn't reproach yourself, Tom. You've rarely spent even the fourth of your income, nor ever the half of it in any year. Our expenses are small, and your profits would have maintained our whole family in affluence, were it not for— I trailed off, wondering what it was. Bad luck? His father's spite? I didn't know. But Tom wept in my arms, as he'd done all those years ago when we were first married, when he'd loved me so fervently and so blindly. His financial ruin was a profound humiliation to him, I knew. But we were more fortunate than most. My father would provide for the children. They'd always have a roof over their heads and food on their table. I had to go to Jeff, Tom blubbered. The shame of going to my own son for help. But he's going to take on my debts because they won't foreclose on him. Creditors are more apt to be lenient with Jeff. He still has his youth, and he's the grandson of Thomas Jefferson. It was a sensible argument, and yet I was horrified. How could we expect Jeff to risk it? I argued against it. I railed against it. But in the end, the men in my family negotiated together in private the instrument that put the burden of the whole family upon Jeff's shoulders. Why won't anyone let us do something to support ourselves? Cornelia sniped, sighing over the figures in my account book. I suppose not until we sink entirely will it do for the granddaughters of Thomas Jefferson to take work in or keep a school. Ellen stared gloomily out the window from a stealthy place behind the curtains. It was Sunday, the day of the week I distributed rations and heard the concerns of the slaves. But it wasn't our people that made my daughter frown. There's a carriage. I suppose it's another visitor trying to avoid paying an innkeeper at our grandpapa's expense. I shared Ellen's hostility toward the leeches and hangers, so I didn't scold her even when, overhearing the visitor's Bostonian accent, she rolled her eyes. It wasn't enough that we had to wine and dine that strange, wandering dullard who walked the length of the country with nothing but one change of clothes to his name. In the face of so many other indignities, we must receive Yankees, too? Our visitor was Joseph Coolidge, a Harvard graduate who had just returned from a recent tour of Europe. "I've now come to see the greatest wonder in our own country," he said, "the Sage of Monticello." We'd heard it all before, albeit perhaps not from such a well-formed mouth. Mr. Coolidge was a handsome man, and it seemed to me that rather than charming my Ellen, the man's beauty irritated her beyond reason. Snorting at him indelicately, she said, "You do realize, of course, that my grandfather isn't a monument, but a man, one who cannot be prevailed upon by every stranger to—" "You're welcome here, Mr. Coolidge," I broke in, "and while I can't say my father is well enough today to receive you, I'll be sure to give him your warmest regards." I'd become something of a palace chamberlain, a keeper of the gate. My father couldn't possibly pass time with every stranger who came to the mountain, so I made excuses. To my surprise, however, Papa was eager to meet this stranger because he was from Boston. "Maybe he'll have some news of Adams." In spite of the damage politics had done to their friendship, the two survivors of the Revolution reminisced and lived on each other's memories. In truth, I sometimes feared that when John Adams died, my father would not be long in following. At supper, which we took at several drop-leaf tables, arranged to accommodate everyone in a style half-French, half-Virginian, the conversation turned to poetry. And while my daughters engaged in every subject upon which their grandfather opined, Ellen was subdued. "I fear my knowledge of poetry isn't expensive enough to impress Miss Ellen," Mr. Coolidge teased.
"Forgive me, sir," my daughter said, "but you seemed impressed enough with yourself for the both of us."
"Ellen," I cried. Her capacity to drive away suitors was now legendary, but seemed hardly sufficient excuse for rude manners.
"It's quite all right, Mrs. Randolph," our visitor said. "I've done too much speaking tonight and not enough learning. Perhaps Miss Ellen would allow me to make up for this lack of gallantry by taking me on a tour through the gardens? If so, I promise to hold my tongue."
"I'm a poor tour guide for the garden," Ellen replied indifferently, and I remembered how I'd tried to put off her father in much the same way. The garden was my sister Anne's domain. She said her sister's name with such sadness that Mr. Coolidge sobered.
"Oh, dear, I'm afraid I didn't know of her loss."
"Oh, Anne isn't dead," Ellen replied, "though she might as well be."
A sharp look from me silenced her. The tensions in our family weren't to be shared with outsiders. Not ever. And she knew it.
Mr. Coolidge cleared his throat.
"Perhaps some music?"
Ellen frowned. "Music is my sister Jenny's domain. Art is Cornelia's."
"And your domain, Miss Ellen?"
He surprised us both, I think, with his persistence. "My grandpapa's book room," she finally said.
"I'd very much like to see it,"
he replied with a triumphant smile. "I'm afraid you can't," Ellen said with a triumphant smile of her own. "It's part of my grandfather's private suite of rooms. Strangers aren't allowed beyond a peek through the glass panes. But if you'd like to borrow a book during your stay, I'm sure it can be arranged." It seemed that the crueler Ellen was, the better he liked her. Days later, at the end of his visit, he declared himself smitten. "That's wonderful to hear," I told the lovelorn young man, "but certainly yours has been a very short acquaintance for such a depth of feeling." With a smile, Mr. Coolidge replied,
"Long enough to know my heart. Now I need merely win hers. Then Ellen and I shall live our lives together happily ever after."
How simple he made it seem. The winning of hearts, living together, eternal happiness. But after 34 years of marriage, I now saw union between man and woman was the same as union among the states. As a series of debates and compromises that might hold it all together for a few more years, or end in a painful separation. My husband, you see, had gone mad. Both our defenders and our enemies will say his madness was always lurking in the savage wildness of his Randolph blood. I let them say it because it absolves me. Tom was always a man of temper, that much is true. But he was driven to madness. His callous father, his bad luck, his choice to marry the daughter of a great man. His sense of himself was always fragile, his spirit easily broken. But in the end, I think I'm the one who snapped it to pieces. I'd argued against allowing our son to assume all our debts. But it seemed never to have occurred to Tom that our boy would take one look at the books and decide there was no hope for it but to sell everything, lock, stock, and barrel.
"So he means to sacrifice me."
My husband had come to confront me in my sitting room, where I'd retired to write a letter to his sister Nancy, and where silhouettes of our children adorned the blue-painted wall. Holding a near-empty glass of liquor in his hand, the length of Tom's body filled the doorway. His voice was low and dangerous.
"Jeff says you support this decision."
I laid my quill aside.
tasting bitter indignation on my tongue. Why did it always come to this? To be forbidden from making decisions, asked for my advice only after the fact, and then blamed for it as if I'd made the trouble in the first instance. Sally had blamed me when my father took my advice about her son. Now Tom blamed me for agreeing with Jeff, and yet neither dilemma had been my making. But my heart filled with agony for my husband, for I understood why he hated Jeff's decision. I hated it too, even as I advocated it. I see no advantage in putting off the evil day to sell everything, Tom, for come it must, and with accumulating interest for every day that it's delayed. Tom's glass went hurtling across the room, where it shattered against the fireplace and fell into the fire. I cried out, but not before Tom was across the room and upon me, shaking me in his steely grip.
After all these years, in this one critical moment, you desert me. You want to see me unmanned. Is that it? To witness the final humiliation of my losing my land?
Tom, land isn't everything. There are many ways a man of your experience...
Land is everything. Without it, you'll see me stripped of not only my honor and pride, but even my citizenship.
Only men who owned 50 acres could vote or hold political office. Without property, Tom would lose even the fig leaf of status. And I felt his impotent rage burning through his skin into mine. He was still strong, so strong that I couldn't squirm away. Tom, we're irretrievably ruined, but Jeff needn't be. I'm thinking of our children's future.
Just one child, Jeff, your favorite. Our son has swindled me, and yet you're choosing him over me.
It was Ellen. Always Ellen who was my favorite, if a favorite must be named. But Jeff was no swindler. If anything, my son's efforts to save something for the family were heroic. The creditors had given him a year to wind up the affairs of the estate and sell for the most profit possible. Our support was the least he deserved. The men in my family had conspired all my life to keep me from thinking in the language of money. But I knew enough to argue now. Mortgages and deeds of trust embrace the whole of your property, and if the banks foreclose, they'll sweep it all away and leave our son as burdened as your father left you.
That boy's malice and greed will see him always secure. He's trying to steal Edgehill from me.
My lips thinned at such an unjust insult hurled at the son who could have easily abandoned us all. Jeff has submitted so affectionately and cheerfully to the privations which we've cost him that he's due nothing but gratitude. For when not distressed with our problems, he's been distracted with managing his grandfather's affairs.
Now we come to it,
my husband said, his words fumed with liquor, as he gave a baleful glance at the locked door between my sitting room and my father's chambers.
Your father is your true worry. No one can ever shine so brightly in your eyes. He's always been your first concern, first and foremost, and you've been artfully persuaded that if I'm completely sacrificed, your father can be saved.
I could make no sense of this. My father's plantations aren't tied to your troubles.
I'm entitled to Monticello,
Tom shouted, his fingers digging so hard into my arms I was sure they'd bruise me.
For 30 years I've worked his plantation, sat patiently at his table, indulged him in every way, asking no recompense, merely waiting my turn to one day be the master of my own family. But you'll never have that, will you? You only serve one man, even if it means my ruin.
The only way to shield Monticello upon my father's death was to leave it to trustees, a plan to which I'd given my consent, without realizing my husband would believe himself disinherited. Tom,
So long as the property is vested in me, you'll always have a home. Papa is only using the law to protect me and the children.
My children. They aren't the center of your life. Your father is.
I might have denied it. It was my duty as a wife and mother to deny it. But in that moment, looking into the bloodshot eyes of a husband come utterly unhinged, a defiance rose up in me. I didn't deny it. I only whispered, "You're hurting me."
That made him shake me harder. "How could I ever hurt you? You never feel a thing. You're unmoved. You're like him, unbending as marble, a statue. What man of flesh and blood can live with that?"
What man, indeed? By any other measure, Tom would be counted a great man. By any other measure than my father's. "You're hurting me," I repeated. Tom let me go all at once before making his retreat, his boots crunching on broken glass. He slammed the door, the sound exploding through the house. I remember that sound and the way it shook me to the marrow of my bones. I remember, too, that Tom slammed the door with such force that the frame cracked and the door bounced back open again. Weeks later, it was still broken, and through that open door walked a man I'd longed to see for years. Chapter 38. Boston, 29 August, 1824. To Thomas Jefferson, from Lafayette.
"Here I am, on American ground. I will hasten to Monticello. How happy I will be to embrace you, my dear friend. And I know the pleasure will be reciprocated."
Lafayette had survived it all. Two wars, the Reign of Terror, imprisonment, and even Napoleon. He was the last surviving general of the American Revolution, and President Monroe had invited Lafayette to celebrate the 47th anniversary of the Battle of Brandywine, where he was wounded in our cause. During Lafayette's triumphal tour, he paid a call upon John Adams, accompanied by John Quincy, the Secretary of State. Lafayette also traveled with the widow of Alexander Hamilton, whom he still called his brother, and in anticipation of Lafayette's reunion with my father, people were already flocking to our mountaintop. Given my state of distress and the rage the mere sight of me evoked in my husband, I closeted myself up with the servants in my sitting room, planning menus and making lists of supplies that must be purchased, while my daughters tended to the locust swarm of visitors. I startled when a knock came at my door, and instead of a servant, in walked a hallucination or apparition or miracle. I couldn't decide which. Not Lafayette, but William Short in the flesh. "Mon Dieu," I cried.
"Chère Jeffy," he said, his green eyes twinkling with mischief at my convent nickname. "It's been too long, Mrs. Randolph."
Indeed it had, I thought, rising to take his hands. A glance out the window at his fancy hired carriage and heavy baggage told me that William hadn't come all the way from Philadelphia on mere impulse. So how did he take me so unawares? My father hadn't warned me to expect him. Was Papa's memory failing him? Or did he hope Mr. Short's visit would be a happy surprise? Suddenly I clutched at my cap, over-aware of my curls, which had with age gone from copper-red to reddish-brown. "Mr. Short, you've caught me in quite a state of déshabillé." He drew my hand to his lips for a kiss.
"Not as great a state of déshabillé as a man with my proclivities desires."
It was a highly inappropriate remark to direct to a lady, married or otherwise. The kind of remark only a Frenchman would make. I blushed like a schoolgirl. But we were surely both of an age to render harmless such flirtation. He studied me while I studied him, taking in the changes. I knew I was thicker about the middle, my face rounder. His hair had silvered, and laugh lines crinkled at the corners of his eyes. I found his presence more reassuring than I could admit.
"What happened here?"
Mr. Short asked, motioning with his chin to the broken door frame.
"Don't tell me your father is tearing all this down to start over again."
I would not discount the possibility when it comes to Papa and his projects. "But Monticello is nearly perfected," I replied, deciding upon evasion. "Johnny Hemmings will send one of his apprentices to fix the door shortly." By one of his apprentices, of course I meant Madison and Esten. But there felt to me something deeply disloyal in mentioning Sally's sons to William, who knew their father was also mine. "We're all being kept very busy in the preparations for Lafayette's visit." Glancing at the array of little papers and notes stored in all the cubbies on my overflowing desk, not to mention the line of servants waiting with baskets outside my open window, he said,
"So I see."
"I'll make sure a room is readied for you."
"Oh, no, I've already picked one out. I'm staying in the room with the trellis wallpaper," he said, with a little incorrigible smirk. "I hear Madison favors it, and it amuses me to think of leaving my nail clippings there for him to find when he stays here. So don't let me interrupt whatever you're doing."
Fighting a smile that would only encourage him, I said, "I'm buying up all the eggs and vegetables the servants can provide me with from their own gardens."
"Aren't your father's own gardens productive here?"
"Certainly. It's only that Papa is a scientist who insists upon growing 50 different varieties of peas, and we must have some variety on our plates for the arrival of Lafayette." Mr. Short laughed.
"Well, I hope I can be a help rather than a burden in the preparations."
"Oh, William, you could never be a burden." But by evening, I knew that to be a lie, for it taxed me to hide our family troubles from him. Since the night Tom slammed out of my sitting room, my husband spoke not two willing words, sour and taciturn at any question addressed to him. Not even by the power of my father's authority and conciliatory nature could my husband be compelled to stay sober. And that first night of Mr. Short's visit, by the time the girls and I returned with the tea tray at 7 o'clock, Tom was drunk. Papa retired at 10 o'clock every evening, and kept to this routine as religiously as he did his morning foot baths. But to discourage Tom's drinking at the table, my father called an early evening.
"I must meet the welcoming committee in the morning, so I'm afraid it's time to retire."
Then, smiling at Mr. Short, he said,
"Still, I'll sleep easier tonight than in many years, having set eyes upon you again, my friend."
William smiled, rising to his feet to take his own leave, but my husband didn't follow suit. Instead, taking another bottle of wine from the dumbwaiter, Tom asked,
"Still a bachelor, Short?"
William was so famously a bachelor that we'd have assuredly heard if his status had changed, but he merely gave a rueful smile.
"Alas, I'm still without a wife." "Lucky,"
Tom murmured, pouring more wine. My girls froze, their teacups half aloft. My boys stiffened in their seats at the far table, their biscuits left without a nibble, all looking to their older brother, Jeff, whose eyes told them to keep their peace. Meanwhile, my shame at Tom's indictment was so acute that I couldn't move from my place. The open insult to me,
fallen so casually from the lips of my husband, came to me like a knife in the dark. I dared not look up from my tea, but merely set the cup back down so no one would see my hand tremble.
"Unlucky, yes," Mr. Short replied at length, pretending to have misheard. "As you say, Randolph, very unlucky. But perhaps that's to put too much upon luck. I'm to blame by declaring myself for women who were too wise to marry me."
My gaze locked on my teacup with the cornflower garland pattern, my stomach churning with upset. Mr. Short's self-deprecating remark was to be understood as chagrin about his wayward duchess, but I understood it to include me. And that was salt in the wound my husband had just opened. Into the awkward silence, Septimia blurted, "Mr. Coolidge declared himself for Ellen. She says she can't be persuaded to marry him, but I don't believe her. Tim, I can't possibly marry Mr. Coolidge," Ellen explained, as if to distract from the undercurrents. "Firstly, I'm an avowed spinster and will make an unreservedly excellent old maid. More importantly, Joseph Coolidge lives in Boston. I couldn't possibly leave Mother and Grandpapa and the rest of you." In that moment, I let myself understand, really understand, why Ellen rejected all her suitors. Ellen was my companion, and my father's nurse when I couldn't be. Did she feel so bound to us that she'd turn away love, as I once did? Into the wound went more salt. Septimia chewed her bottom lip. "But if you truly love Mr. Coolidge, you have to marry him, even if it takes you from us. Don't you think so, Mr. Short?" I dared not look at William during his excruciating hesitation. Finally, he said,
"I am the wrong man to ask. In my experience, the heart is always torn between competing attachments. I once considered my fate a great tragedy, but now I think it a blessing. After all, I've known extraordinary love and have nephews to whom I look upon as sons." "Sons," Tom snorted. "Everyone counts sons a blessing, but I assure you, daughters are a man's only comfort in the end."
The veins on Jeff's good arm swelled as he clenched his fist. For months now, my eldest son had endured his father's hostility, but his honor could finally stand no more.
He glared at Tom. "Do you want to say what you mean, sir?"
Under the table, I put a hand on my son's knee, silently pleading with him to swallow his bile. He could do it, I knew.
But Tom's dark eyes flashed savagely. "If you were any kind of son, you'd leave me a few acres on Edgehill for a vineyard or a sawmill."
I gasped that Tom would broach our financial troubles in front of a guest, even William, perhaps especially him.
"I'm the kind of son who won't lie to you," Jeff shot back, shoving from the edge of the table. "I can't leave you even an acre. If we somehow manage to keep Edgehill in the family, I need the whole of it to produce tobacco, and to produce Negroes,"
Tom accused. Jeff winced.
"Do you want to leave your wife and children with nothing for their survival but the charity of my grandfather? Is that what you want?"
Tom stumbled to his feet as if ready to beat my boy, and my daughters let out terrified cries.
"Gentlemen,"
our guest interrupted, white-faced with anger, and with an authority few men but my father possessed.
"It's unseasonably warm in here,"
William said with calculation, like the diplomat he'd once been.
"I'll escort the ladies outside where the cool mountain air may calm and soothe."
It ought to have shamed them. Both of them. If a quarrel was inevitable, it ought to be taken outside. Instead, my children and I were forced to flee our tables while the argument raged on. And somehow, I found myself on the winding flower walk in the glow of the setting sun, staring at showy scarlet plumes of coxcomb and golden marigolds, fighting back the tears that burned behind my eyes. Anne, my beautiful eldest daughter, whom I sometimes despaired of ever seeing again, had planted those flowers. And now the rest of my family was splintering apart, with my oldest and dearest friend as a witness.
"How much is the debt?"
William asked. I couldn't tell him. Not even as furious with Tom as I was. It would have been a disloyalty. "It doesn't matter. It's no excuse for what you were forced to witness. I apologize."
"Don't you apologize," William broke in with a sharp edge of anger. "Mr. Randolph is shockingly disrespectful to you. I cannot imagine your father would countenance it."
"He wouldn't. He doesn't," I insisted, trying to find the words to explain. "It's simply that Tom feels abandoned. As I recall, you were once just as angry with me, and for the same reason." William must have known that Marie reported back his long-ago furious renunciation of our love. He couldn't deny it. Instead, he asked,
"Is it true that your son intends to use his father's property as a slave-breeding farm?"
I swallowed, shaking my head. I might have lied to him, as we lied to visitors and to ourselves all the time. But it wasn't in me to deceive him. I don't know what Jeff intends in that regard. It was a mortifying admission, one that revealed the ugliness beneath the glow of all the pretty flowers. An admission far uglier than I'd allowed myself to accept before. William paused beside spires of lavender and pinched the bridge of his nose, a gesture that filled me with overwhelming shame. No one else could have made me feel shame for it. I'd never, could never condemn the men in my life who relied upon slavery, especially when my lion of a father believed himself impotent against the evil, and my idealistic husband had been politically ruined for his efforts to stop it. But I was now standing beside the man who had offered me a different reality, a different life from which I had turned away. And I felt some shame and regret for that, too. On the 11th of September, in her best dress, Virginia made her bridal procession, not at her father's home of Edgehill, but at Monticello. And awaiting her upon the grass-green floor of the entry hall was her happy groom, Mr. Trist. My new son-in-law beamed with joy as he spoke his vows, and we all sighed happily when my sweet Virginia spoke hers. Everyone but Tom, that is. He stood stiffly at my side, as if he were merely a guest and not the father of the bride. He delegated all those responsibilities to her grandfather, saying that he didn't wish to ruin the wedding with his malaise. I think he recognized in himself the malignant spirit that had broken free and meant only to shield Ginny from it. But our poor daughter kept searching out her sullen father's eyes in the crowd, pleading a smile from him. And it seemed to take all the strength Tom had just to lift the corners of his mouth. He didn't laugh or mingle in conversation. He didn't dance, and he didn't offer toasts, though he drank deeply whenever they were offered. So, for the bride's sake, I tried to be happy enough for both of us. It wasn't difficult. For nearly 6 years, Mr. Trist had been constant in his attachment to Ginny. They'd resisted all our attempts to discourage their love, until we were simply forced to acquiesce to its power. Theirs was not a marriage for money or advantage, but born of long friendship, shared troubles, and a true meeting of hearts. They might live poor as church mice all their lives, but their romance was perfectly obvious to everyone. And when the bride and groom pledged themselves to one another,
their voices trembling with emotion. It wasn't Tom who gazed at me with wistful remembrance of our wedding day. Instead, I felt William's gaze upon me, as if imagining the wedding we'd never had. Glancing furtively at him over the punch bowl and floral arrangements, I found myself snared by his wistful smile. I remembered that, like my new son-in-law, he, too, was once an aspiring diplomat that everyone feared would be penniless. My eldest daughter had married a man more like her father than I wished to contemplate. But Jenny was taking the risk I never took. Later, William sat beside me to listen when Papa gifted Jenny with a gilded cittern guitar, with which she serenaded her new groom. "Love endures," I thought, then tried to shake the thought away. But it was a thought that stayed with me well into the night. Thereafter, Tom absented himself from Monticello. He didn't come for dinner, nor take tea in the early evening. It was only after the music was played and our guests had retired that he returned, hiding away in the North Pavilion, refusing my company. I knew my husband was in pain, shattered to atoms in body and spirit. I hurt for him. I wanted to reassure him of my love, of my father's love, of his family's love, even Jeff's love. But the only thing Tom wanted from me was to persuade Jeff to leave the creditors unpaid. And for the sake of our children, that was the one thing I wouldn't do. "Where do you think he goes during the day?" Ellen murmured as the younger children ran inside the house ahead of us, their feet pitter-pattering across the cherry and beechwood parquet floor. I suspected Tom actually went to Charlottesville to drink in the taverns, but couldn't bear to tell even Ellen as much. "I'm sure I don't know." Ellen leaned against one of the columns of the west portico. "I can bring my father a tray tonight. He's made a recluse of himself in the North Pavilion, but he might open the door for me. If not me, then Septimia." Yes, he might open the door for Septimia, because she was a child, but I didn't intend to use her in such a way. "Your father has always suffered dark moods. Then he comes out of them. He always comes out of them. So we must give him privacy." From the parlor, where he'd been setting up a chessboard, my father called, "Ah, Ellen, come play." Papa was inordinately proud of both his granddaughter and his chess set, a gift from the French court. "I've been telling Mr. Short that if you'd been born a man, you'd have been a great one. So show him how you've learned to use my chessmen." William had been examining Papa's magic double doors, which, by some ingenious innovation, opened of their own accord. But he looked up when Ellen pulled a crimson damask chair to the board by the window and challenged him to a game. "You won't go easy on account of my sex, will you, Mr. Short?" William smirked. "To the contrary, I'm contemplating asking special dispensation on account of my age." Ellen threw her head back in laughter, a dark tendril of hair escaping the bun at her nape, and proceeded to a ruthless victory. Smiling in easy defeat, William turned to me. "Your daughters have inherited your talents, Mrs. Randolph. Ellen's wit, Virginia's music, Cornelia's artistry, why her architectural drawings rival those of professional draftsmen. I've advised your father to hire her for the university." My girls were delighted by this praise, and I was too. Even so, I felt compelled to say, "You forget I was an abysmal artist in my youth. To this day, I can scarcely sketch a pea."
"I remember perfectly well," William countered. "It's only that paints and pencils were never the tools of your trade. You were a different kind of artist. The craft you mastered was spycraft."
"Spycraft?"
Ellen asked, eyes round at the mention of the disreputable business. My children were fascinated, and William looked very satisfied.
Shall I tell your children how you rooted out an English spy?
I gave my assent with an indifferent shrug and a secret smirk, deciding that so many years had passed there could hardly be scandal in it. The story of how I'd stolen papers from the rooms of Charles Williamos was one my father had never heard before, and in hearing it, poor Papa looked as if he didn't know whether to scold or congratulate us.
The secrets come out only when your children think you're too old and feeble to discipline them.
We laughed together beneath the rows of paintings that my father prized. All of us had needed to laugh, which left me even more grateful for William's visit. He paid court to my father with the affection and comfort of an old friend, bolstering his spirits. He played games with my children and told them stories about Lafayette, which put them in even more excited anticipation of setting eyes upon our beloved Marquis. William made us forget our troubles. He made it easy to pretend that my husband wasn't lurking on the grounds each night, or even that I wasn't married at all. After winning another game, Ellen announced, "Mr. Short, you're paying too much homage to your queen, but I'll allow you to avenge yourself with one last game."
"I'm content to leave the field in ignominious defeat," William said.
She clasped her hands together. "I fear your years in Philadelphia have turned you into a Yankee. No Virginia gentleman born and bred would bow so easily." A Yankee. It no longer had the same bite on her tongue as it did the day Joseph Coolidge came to our door. That's how I knew that my Ellen was in love. In love with a man she wouldn't marry because she feared to abandon me. That night, I took her chin and made her look into my eyes. "If you can be happy with Mr. Coolidge, then marry him. You must go and be happy." Her long dark lashes fluttered with surprise. "But I'm accustomed to spinsterhood, and my duty—" "Don't let duty chain you," I said, though it would break my heart to lose her. "Not to me, not to your father, not even to your grandfather." Ellen blinked, her brow furrowed. "But I wish to do as you've always done, Mama." My heart sank at the sentiment, sweet as it was. There had been sacrifice enough for duty. Ellen deserved to make the choice I hadn't been able to. I grasped her hands. "No, Ellen. You've done your duty. It's time to consider your own happiness." For I was determined that my precious daughter, the one I clung to the way my father clung to me, would well and truly find it. I awakened to the silhouette of a man in my bedroom doorway. It was my husband, drunk and ornery. He stumbled into my closet, where he must have still expected to find a bed. Smashing instead into trunks and hat boxes, he uttered a dark curse. "Tom," I asked, not fully awake. He never answered. Instead, he followed my voice in the dark, then hefted his body onto the bed, climbing atop me.
"You're my wife,"
he snarled, yanking down the blankets. "You're drunk," I accused, pushing him away.
"So you're the wife of a drunk,"
he said, forcing upon me a rough, wet kiss. I didn't want him. Not like this. Not angry and rough and stinking of wine. "No, Tom, we decided—" My words were cut off by a blow to the face. I tasted blood and anger, even as my head swam with terror and shock and pain.
"You decided,"
Tom said, pinning my arm and getting his knee between mine. I might have cried or pleaded or used feminine wiles to prevail upon him to let me go. But I did none of those things. Instead, when he tugged at his trousers to free himself, I freed myself with an upward jerk of my knee. Unsteady from drink, he toppled from me, howling in pain. I rolled out of the bed, my bare feet pounding on the floor as I ran. He gave chase, knocking pictures from the wall, tripping over a small table in the hall, sending knick-knacks clattering to the floor. Hearing the commotion, Ellen flung open the door to her room, while children stumbled down the stairs from their rooms above. Crowding around me, the children whimpered in confusion, and George began to cry. Tom glared at me where I stood within the refuge of my children's arms. There was something akin to pure hatred in his eyes. By Tom's accounting, he'd been rejected by everyone in his life. His father, my father, the legislators and voters of Virginia, and me. This refusal of him was another betrayal. But he didn't pry me away from our children to force himself upon me. Instead, without a word, he lumbered back down the stairs. And I didn't follow or even call after him. Instead, I found myself grateful that William's lodging on the first floor had kept him from being witness to yet another humiliation.
Chapter 39. I fell out of bed, I said to explain my bruises. Sipping chocolate, Papa sighed.
He wouldn't have fallen from an alcove bed.
I nodded absently, grateful that my children said nothing of their father's rampage. They all joined into the conspiracy of silence. But William Short wasn't fooled for a moment. He was unusually subdued as we took our chocolate from my father's favorite urn. His face as serious and stoic as the plaster busts hovering over us of Washington, Franklin, and Lafayette. And later, once my increasingly frail and elderly father found his ease in his Campeachy chair, William followed me on my rounds beneath the mulberry trees, delivering rations to slave cabins.
Your husband mistreats you.
I could say nothing. I could only hurry along the road, hoping our people would swarm around me for their parcels and force William to some other subject. But he was, as always, a dogged man.
Did he strike you?
William, leave it be, I said, picking up my pace, suddenly desperate to flee, to escape his infernal prying into facts. William darted in front of me, blocking my path.
I thought you loved him.
One look into William's eyes, and I came undone. All the emotions, the anger, the bitterness, the fear, everything I'd so carefully wound tight into my pleasant and placid smile now unraveled, and I fled. Dropping the basket in the road, I took hold of my skirts and hurried away from him down the hill into the vegetable garden, for it seemed the most likely avenue of escape, past rows of artichokes and beans and brown Dutch lettuces. I didn't think he'd follow me, because it meant sinking his well-made shoes into the autumn muck. But he more than followed. He chased.
"Patsy," he cried, taking the liberty of using my childhood name.
And when we reached the garden pavilion, he took the further liberty of grasping my wrist before I could close the glass-paned door in his face. Again, he insisted,
"I thought that you loved him."
"And I thought you loved Rosalie," I shot back. "So love has carried neither one of us to the destination we wished."
Startled, he let go of me.
And I retreated inside the square little fortress lit by tall windows on every side. My father had built it so that he might peacefully survey the whole of his world in any direction. But I tucked myself into a corner, feeling vulnerable and exposed.
At length, William mustered the courage to step inside, rubbing his face in his hands.
Rosalie said she wouldn't marry. She feared for her husband's reputation. She feared to leave her elderly relations. She feared to leave her country. But the truth was, she simply wouldn't marry me. When last in France, I learned that she'd married the Marquis de Castellon, an aging nobleman of some prestige. So trust me when I say that I understand perfectly what it is to love someone who can never give you what you want or deserve.
I withdrew farther into the corner, wrestling the sob that threatened to overtake me. He stood beside me, our hands brushing where they dangled. We touched, skin to skin, an unmistakable intimacy as his finger linked softly, tenderly with my own. And a longing I'd buried so long ago coiled within me anew, very much alive. We breathed in perfect harmony, bound again, finger to finger, even as we ached for more. And I felt the strength and comfort which I'd not experienced this way in more than 30 years. His voice was a whisper.
I loved Rosalie, yes. But I loved you first, Patsy. Always have loved you. Always will.
He turned to me, touching my bruised lip very gently, right where it hurt. A very tender gesture. Then he moved in, lowering his head as if he meant to kiss me. And it took every bit of strength in me to turn away.
Who is he to you?
The growled words startled me, coming from behind me in the wash house where I'd come in the cool of the evening to search out some missing stockings. Sally was there, having set soiled clothing to boil in a copper cauldron outside. Sally disliked when my daughters and I visited the dependencies, where the slaves did their work, for my father's concubine ruled here, in her quiet and competent way. Perhaps that's why she turned her head with scarcely disguised imperiousness to see who was stooped in the low doorway. But I knew before I looked. It was Tom, having lumbered down from the nearby north pavilion where he was sleeping these days, his face red from cheek to jowl, with rage or liquor or both.
"Get out!"
he barked at the laundry girls, and they darted past him in the doorway. Sally was slower to obey, her glance flicking to me. Only when I nodded did she tug at the bodice of her gown to make it straight, then gracefully ducked under my husband's outstretched arms to make her exit. We stood there then, my husband and I, the sound of the laundry bubbling and hissing in the cauldron behind him. Then Tom roared,
"Who is he to you? William Short, that sanctimonious stock-jobber, that morally bankrupt lecher. I saw you. I saw both of you."
My heart leapt to my throat like a shot from a pistol, and I could do nothing but brazen it out. "I can't imagine what you mean."
"You left your basket in the road,"
Tom said, his teeth clenched together like an animal trap that had taken so long to spring it was now rusted shut.
"Couldn't fathom where you'd got to until I looked up at the garden pavilion. I saw you there, with him, in his arms. I saw it."
Sweat broke across my brow and the nape of my neck. Not only from the big fire under the cauldron, nor even the heat of this stifling little room, but because guilt seared its way through me until I worried I might faint dead away. Haltingly, I began to say, "I wasn't in his arms, Tom. You know he's an old friend, a dear one. He offered me comfort and solace in a moment of need.
That's all.
That was a lie. That wasn't all William Short had offered me in my father's garden pavilion. He told me he loved me. He tried to kiss me, too, but I'd turned away. Nothing carnal took place, I insisted. He was my suitor once, in France, but I spurned Mr. Short, then married you. I hoped it'd soothe his wounded pride. It didn't.
William Short makes whores of other men's wives.
These words carried such quiet fury that they frightened me more than if he'd shouted them. Tom came toward me, very slowly, very quietly, wrapping his big hand around my throat like Charles Bankhead had once done. Tom didn't squeeze, but merely held me there against the wall, slightly suspended like a rag doll hanging from his string.
Short is infamous. His exploits are so well known he was too ashamed to make his home in Virginia. But you're giving him what you won't give me. Isn't that right?
How absurd it was. Beggaring belief, even. At our age, for two men to be vying for a mother of 11 children. Tom, you're letting jealousy poison your mind. Don't you realize the absurdity?
Tell me you have embedded him. Go on, lie to me, you convent-trained whore.
My husband's chest heaved with anger so deep and divisive that it seemed to open the very earth between us. It seemed to make strangers of us. And perhaps we were strangers now. For I was no longer the young wife who believed that her husband's violence was her own fault. And slowly, pulling from some reserve inside myself I didn't know I had, I stood taller on my side of that chasm. Whatever I am, Thomas Mann Randolph, you're not worthy of. On that last, I broke free of him. But I didn't run. I'd run from him when he'd tried to force himself upon me. Run from him like Anne ran from her maniac of a husband. But I was done running from Tom. I walked out of that wash house, even as my husband called after me.
I'll have satisfaction, Martha. I'll call him out.
I snorted with bitter laughter, grateful to be certain of one thing. William will never fight a duel with you.
If he won't, it's because he's no Virginia gentleman.
No, Tom. He won't duel you because you aren't.
Not anymore.
William and I met in the grove, a canopy of autumn leaves overhead, strangely reminiscent of that long-ago day he found me on the ground, having fallen from my father's high horse.
Patsy, say something.
Those words, too, were an echo of the past. But I was hearing them again now as he pleaded,
"Your silence cuts me deeper than the sharpest rebuke."
He was wrong. My words would cut him deeper, I knew. And I wished I could say anything other than what I'd come to tell him. But we weren't young comrades amongst a tangle of saplings at the start of our journey any longer. We were grizzled veterans standing atop the rotting fruit of our long struggle. And so, with the stink from the leaves of my father's chinaberry trees in my nostrils, I forced myself to speak, even as the words themselves left a painful sting on my lips. I must ask you to leave Monticello. William reeled, as if he'd taken a blow.
I meant to comfort you and have made a fool of myself with unwanted attentions. I'll leave, of course, if that's your desire, but I promise I'll never allow myself such a lapse. It will never happen again.
I wanted it to happen again. I wanted that desperately. You're no fool, William. And your attentions are not unwanted. To the contrary,
They're temptations that my virtue is no proof against.
He startled, his expression lighting upon some hope that I was soon to dash.
But Tom saw us. He saw us in the garden pavilion. So you must go and never come back.
God, William.